the missions, all of the hell we'd run through together, all of the blood and smoke and gunfire, all of the times we limped off the field when damn near everyone else was dead, all of that was hardwired into him on a deep, deep level. It went deeper than his fear, the way it does with all good soldiers. He dropped to all fours and trotted over to me, turned and sat down by my side, ready, in position, with me. We both took a lingering look at the horrors and mysteries behind the glass. Then we looked at each other. Then we got the hell out of there. Chapter 111. The Hangar, Floyd Bennett Field, Brooklyn, New York. Doc Holliday pointed to the picture of the tentacle that still filled one of the big view screens in the talk. Her finger trembled visibly.
What in the hell is that?
When no one answered, she swung the finger around and pointed to one of her lab techs.
You, get to a terminal, call up image recognition and cross-reference with the fossil record database and any other source you can access. I want to know everything about that thing, all the way down to the size of its dick, and I want it in the next 10 minutes.
The tech literally broke into a dead run. She pivoted and speared another tech with her glare.
You, I want a different search. Go into art files and other image sources. If someone so much as doodled that thing on a cocktail napkin, I want a full report. Move!
She kept rattling orders. Junie stood and watched, finally impressed by Doc Holliday. Until now, she had been getting very frustrated by the woman's reluctance to think outside of the box. That had been a flaw in Doctor Who's makeup. Bill Hu had flatly refused to believe in the possibility of extraterrestrial life until the unfolding extinction machine case forced him to. Foot dragging was always tedious to Junie, but 10 times more so when Joe's life was on the line. When Doc paused to gasp in a breath, Junie asked,
"How can I help?"
Doc looked around, clearly seeing no one else that she needed to make jump. She turned back to Junie.
If there's more I need to know, then damn well tell me. I am officially open for business in every possible way. We got big green reptilians, madness-inducing green crystals, interdimensional gateways, and giant alien tentacles. I think we can declare my skepticism dead and damn well buried. So, as Joe is so fond of saying, hit me.
Chapter 112. Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia. There is a popular military acronym, SNAFU. It stands for Situation Normal, All Fucked Up. Some people will insist it's fouled up, but it's not. It's fucked, as we pretty much were. Duffy said that the newcomers were massing at the doors but had not yet breached.
Not sure what they're waiting for, cowboy. No breaching tools that I can see, but they haven't touched the hand scanner or keycard box. Wait. One guy in the front has his hand to his ear. I think he's talking to someone, maybe getting orders. I'll send a bird drone over to try and eavesdrop.
Bug, I asked, can you hack the transmission on the new players?
Working on it, cowboy,
he said, and I could hear him hammering on his keyboard.
It's some kind of cyclical scrambler, something new and spiffy.
Tick-tock, said Top. I've got guards coming.
Me too, said Bunny. But they're still on slow foot patrol. No one seems to be running. No alarms going off inside. What gives? Are the jokers outside on their side, or did someone else just buy into this poker game?
Unknown, I said. Don't even know if the rent-a-cops up there knew about the pro ballers I ran into.
Guys outside look like serious players,
warned Duffy.
Call the play, suggested Top.
That was all I got out because suddenly there was a sound. Very loud, very odd. Impossible to really describe. Kind of a gigantic whoomp. It shook the entire building with such force that my immediate reaction was bomb, but it wasn't. I've heard thousands of explosions, from firecrackers up to fuel-air cluster bombs. This wasn't like any blast I'd ever heard. It was softer, more compressed, close to the sound of something very large and flat being forcibly slammed down on a flat table, with the sound of impact softened by the air as it is forced to escape. Like that, but not like that. It was also something that vibrated everything. I felt it like a punch to the breastbone. It hurt my heart and buckled my legs. And I went down into a duck walk that ended with me on my knees, crammed up against the corridor wall. Ghost belly flopped and skidded past me. We both froze there, gasping, feeling momentarily battered and sick. All of the alarms in the entire building went off at once. Smith, outside, was the first to call in.
Cowboy, was that an explosion? It looked like the whole damn building shook.
I don't, but again I was interrupted.
Spartan to Cowboy, yelled Duffy. Be advised you have hostiles coming in all three doors.
In the distance I could hear gunfire and screams. So many screams. Chapter 113 Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia.
Soft X-fill my shiny white ass.
Cowboy to Echo Team, I yelled as I struggled back to my feet. Cleared to go, weapons hot, hard X-fill, repeat, hard X-fill. I whipped the door open and ran into the hall with Ghost at my heels. There was no one in sight, but in the distance, coming from several other parts of the building, I could hear the gunfire. Various calibers. Shouts in Russian, some in English, all too muffled to understand. The screams were not the high-pitched shrieks of pain. Not exactly. I've heard enough battlefield injury cries to know them in their various intensities, and this wasn't that. This was more like madhouse screeching, filled with power and raw emotion. I heard one voice shouting,
Zatknись! Zatknись!
Over and over again. Shut up. No one seemed to be responding to him, though. His voice was rising to a hysterical pitch and sounded odd, wrong. Then there was another louder voice bellowing at my men to stand down. From the barrage of responding gunfire, it was clear my guys weren't all that much in a stand-down kind of mood.
Ghost, I said. Find Sergeant Rock. Shield, shield, shield.
My dog was trained to locate my team by real names or combat call signs, and he bounded forward toward the left end of the corridor, and I raced after. We were halfway down the hall toward our intended exit route when a door opened and two men stepped out of a stairwell. Both were dressed in identical black suits, both carried automatic rifles. Soldiers, not guards. They immediately swung their barrels toward us and began shooting. What happened next occurred all inside the bubble of a cracked half second. A bullet punched into my hip and slammed me halfway around. White, hot pain exploded in every nerve, but even with its intensity, I knew that the round hadn't penetrated. The Kevlar and spider silk had done their job, and the impact dampeners had sloughed off some of the force. There was impact pain, but not the hot, burning agony of a bullet passing through. I used the impact to spin me all the way around and came out of it shooting. The two soldiers split left and right, and my rounds chased them. Ghost was already moving, having launched himself at them before their fingers had squeezed the triggers. He was a white missile, all teeth and claws and savage intent. The closest man went crashing back against the wall. I corrected my aim and used my pistol to put two center mass in the other guy. He was not wearing the most advanced shock-absorbing, bullet-stopping body armor currently available, and I was firing armor-piercing rounds. He sat down and died, his gun hitting the polished floor and sliding 10 feet. All of that done in a heartbeat. I wheeled to see if Ghost needed help. He didn't. It takes a little bit of time for him to wrestle a guy down and subdue him if the command was to own. Killing is always quicker. It simplifies the math. I limped forward, feeling for damage. My hip hurt like a bastard, but it held. Nothing broken, I thought. Then heard a glassy rattle. When I checked the pouch on my upper thigh, I found that the round had smashed the green crystal gun I'd taken from Yuri's safe. It was in 100 pieces, and some jagged ends had slashed through the Faraday bag. None had sliced through my trousers, though, so there was that. I debated throwing it the hell away because, let's face it, green crystals in any form were beginning to freak me the fuck out. But before I could do that, there was noise from inside the stairwell, and I did a quick look around the doorway to see a third man coming up fast, gun socketed into his shoulder. I shot him twice in the face, and he tumbled back down. The moment became instantly still as I listened for more immediate threats. Nothing close to hand, All of the weird screams and sounds of battle were downstairs and in remote parts of the building. Even so, there was an odd little flicker inside my head and heart as I looked at the three dead men. And for the strangest moment, I saw my own face superimposed over theirs. And in that fragment of a second, I wished it was me lying there with my brains blown out, with all of my bad memories splattered across the floor. An ugly little voice seemed to whisper to me, "That's how the pain ends. Miss the next shot. Pause for a heartbeat and all of this goes away. Helen and Grace and your mom, they're all waiting for you." It stopped me, chilled me, horrified me. Because that inner voice was mine, or one of my voices. It was the modern man aspect of my fractured personality, the civilized part of me, the one who would have been dominant if Helen and I had never been attacked. Maybe the real me. The modern man was not a killer, not a soldier, not a cop. He wasn't part of anything that happened in my life after Helen. Nothing. He was stalled at the ending point of my innocence, standing on that cliff edge. Never once in all my life had he ever spoken so harshly, so savagely to me. Never once in my life had he made so much goddamn sense. "Let it end and be free," he told me. The cop part of my mind rose up and began to talk, to reason, to construct arguments against that kind of insane thinking, but he was howled down by the killer. Guilt, heartbreak, despair were all as foreign to him as the kind of weariness of spirit I heard in the modern man's voice. The killer threw back his head and roared an inarticulate challenge, in hatred and defiance. And then I heard Ghost bark. Once, twice, not at another threat heading our way. He was barking at me. Sharp, angry, frightened barks. I flinched away from those barks and toppled back against the wall, gasping as if I'd run up a flight of stairs. That fast, it was all over. I was back in complete control, and there was no inner argument. It was so sudden and so total that I had a very hard time accepting that I'd heard the modern man say those things. Looking inward, even he seemed surprised. Ghost barked once more, low and mean and urgent. "I'm okay," I said, gasping it out. "I'm good." The wolf eyed me without tolerance or mercy. I straightened and I could feel the killer looking out through my eyes. In the presence of his true pack leader, Ghost sat down and even wagged his bushy tail. "My life is a freak show. Ask anyone." Chapter 114. Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia. "Area," I said to Ghost. It was the command to use his canine ears and nose to assess the stairwell the two soldiers had come out of. He whuffed quietly. "All clear." We went down fast. I cleared each corner and made sure, though, because even a dog as well-trained and experienced as Ghost can be wrong. We went down three flights, and with each step the sounds of battle grew louder. We moved out into an empty hall. As we ran along it, I tapped my earbud to the team channel and left the signal open. "Sergeant Rock," I said quietly. "SITREP." I wasn't sure if he'd be able to answer, but his gruff voice was in my ear, breathless and tense.
"Got some weird shit coming down, cowboy," he said. "The new hostiles are soldiers, no doubt about, no rank or insignia, but they move like spec ops. But the security guards are queering the math. Those assholes have suddenly gone totally apeshit. They're shooting up the place. Not really aiming, but throwing a lot of ordnance downrange, aiming at anything that moves, including the soldiers. Don't make sense to me, but that's the situation."
"Sergeant Rock," I said, "confirm that the Pushkin guards are shooting at everyone."
"Confirm, cowboy. It's like they're drunk or something. But there's a shit ton more of them than we thought. Not just more guards, but a bunch of guys dressed like factory workers, too, at least 30. Some guys in white lab coats, too, coming out of everywhere."
Bunny came out of the call. "Got that here, too. Couple of doors open to a lab or something. These assholes are streaming out. Most do not have firearms. Repeat, most civilians are not carrying guns. They're coming at us with broom handles and fire extinguishers. They're not even organized."
"Green Giant, have you engaged the soldiers yet?"
"Negative.
Coffee and I are moving through a suite of offices, only encountering some guards and civilian staff.
Smith chimed in.
You're about to have a lot of company, Green Giant. Count 10 hostiles, possibly more.
3 more SUVs just pulled in on the far side of the lot,
called Duffy.
Well, I thought, isn't that just peachy?
Keep them entertained, Spartan, I ordered, and he actually chuckled. Fruitcake. Green Giant and Coffee opened the toy box.
Hoo-ah, said an enthusiastic Tate.
The toy box was a satchel of really nasty booby traps and urban warfare limited area mines developed by Doc Holliday. Tate, who was the techiest of us, loved all that shit. While Top and Cole had been investigating the loading bay and I'd been visiting the damn Twilight Zone, Bunny and Tate spent their time preparing for a worst-case scenario with Doc's gruesome gizmos.
Everybody turn your tinglers on, said Bunny.
We all did. Tinglers are a real-time warning system hardwired into our suits that let us know where the booby traps were, what they were, and which routes were safe for us to use.
Sergeant Rock, I called. What's your 20?
We're still in the loading bay, rear exit, said Top. But we're boxed. I have shooters between me and the exit and behind us firing from cover. And a lot of those crazy-ass guards and lab techs running everywhere. We're going to have to start dropping civilians if we're going to get clear of this.
Coming to you, I said. Duffy chimed in.
Echo team, be advised you kids better haul ass or hide, because there's a shit ton of them about to storm the castle. We're not getting out of this without a gunfight.
Top said.
This is going south on us, cowboy.
And Bunny was back, yelling in near panic.
Fuck, I just had 2 lab guys try to bite me.
Confirm. Bite? I demanded. A chill raced through me nonetheless. We'd encountered biters before. The living dead infected from Saif al-Din, the genetically enhanced berserkers, and the bloodthirsty Red Knights. I could feel terror boiling in my gut.
Roger that,
Bunny said, sounding out of breath.
It's cool. It's cool. I don't think we're dealing with Saif al-Din. These guys had heartbeats. When they couldn't bite me, they began punching each other. I banged their heads together and they went out for a nap. But there's more chasing us. We're heading to the lobby. No other route possible, but there's a shitload of these assholes on our 6. Coffee's leaving some parting gifts on our back trail.
Green Giant, are you able to confirm if the hostiles are wearing heavy rings? White metal. There was a rustling sound and then he said,
Yeah, both of them. And oh, shit. The rings have a little cap on them, and they're open. I can see some of that green crystal stuff. Get away from them, I roared. Do it right now.
Okay,
whispered Bunny.
We've moved to an alcove. We're good.
Echo team, listen to me, I said tersely. All of the hostiles are wearing rings with green quartz chips. The rings are activated by an electronic signal, and it's somehow been sent. Assume that everyone else in this building is under the influence of crystal energy. It sounded stupid to say that. But no one laughed. We'd gone past that point. We need to just end this, I said. Eat your gun, whatever. End it. And then I froze as the echo of my own words came back to me. I tried to fix it, take it back, change it. I yelled at them to disregard, but the wrong words came out of my mouth.
It's too damn quiet in here, I heard myself say. I can't hear my own damn thoughts. I can't take it.
There was a weird sensation in my arm, and I looked down to see my hand raising the pistol toward my own face. Chapter 115 Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia. Ghost attacked me. He launched himself into the air and slammed into me with both front paws, knocking me back, ramming me against the wall. I hit my head and the point of one elbow and my trigger finger jerked and the blast blinded and deafened me. Fresh pain flared through the bruised muscles of my shoulders and lower back. I slid down and Ghost came at me again, standing on my chest and snarling, his gleaming teeth inches from my face. Beyond those teeth, though, I did not see anger. I saw total mad panic. I shook my head, trying to make sense of my own thoughts. The gun. Jesus Christ, the gun. My cheeks stung from powder burns, and there was a terrible ringing in my ear. Ghost barked at me, but I couldn't hear him. Somehow that scared me more than anything so far. It was like watching a movie with the sound turned all the way down. The only noise was the ringing in my ears and something else. It was like wind, but distant. Faint, like the breeze you can hear in parts of the Grand Canyon, far away and ghostly. There was darkness at the edge of my vision. "Let me fall," I said, or thought I said. Ghost kept barking in total silence. The fear in his eyes was like a fist that punched me in the face. It was one of the worst things I'd ever seen in my life. I pushed him back with palsied hands, and then I slapped my own face. Hard. Really fucking hard. Again and again. Ghost barked again, and this time I heard it. Faint, but there. And in my mind I ran toward that sound, fleeing from those distant, empty winds, running from my own thoughts. He kept barking, drawing me out of the deep and silent darkness, and he was the light. That bright white fur, those desperate eyes. Then I heard voices. I turned, fumbling for my gun, but immediately realized the voices were in my head, in my ear. My team. They were yelling. There were other sounds, snarls and screams and gunfire, but my mind fought me, trying to wash the sounds away again. So I belted myself across the face again and again. I punched myself in the stomach and then pounded a fist against my bruised hip. It helped. The pain was specific. It was tangible, and it helped. Top was yelling for me, but I had no voice and did not trust what I would say, so he took command of the situation.
"Okay, Echo Team," he roared. "We ain't playing no more. Let's light these motherfuckers up."
I fell over, and it took forever for me to get to my hands and knees. The torn Faraday bag was there with the spilled pieces of broken green crystal. I wanted to pick them up, take them, eat them, push them into my skin, put them into my eyes. Ghost shifted to stand over them, growling again. I heard it now, and when I looked at him, I knew that he would tear me apart to keep me from those stones. I hated him. I wanted to kill the damn mutt. I wanted to stab him to death and wear his skin, and I screamed. It bubbled up from deep inside of me, and I screamed so loud that I could feel my throat ripping raw, and I flung myself away, falling, crawling like a baby, scrabbling, kicking my way along the floor, away from that green glow. Ghost stood his ground and watched me, his sides heaving, drool dripping from his lips. Suddenly, an explosion rocked the whole building. It wasn't the soft whump of earlier, but something much bigger, much worse. And it seemed to come from everywhere, rippling out in waves of destructive force that made the floor under our feet writhe as if we were on the back of some living thing. The poured linoleum cracked underfoot. I tried to stand, but fell at once. Ghost went skittering and sliding away from me. As I reached for the wall to steady myself, jagged cracks whipsawed from ceiling to floor, snorting out plumes of brick dust. Framed art fell from its anchors and crashed to the floor, and I could hear pipes inside the walls groaning as they were twisted out of shape. I gasped, "What the?" And then there was a second massive crunch, as if a towering giant had swung a pile driver punch into the very heart of the building. The shockwave plucked me off the ground like I was nothing and slammed me into the wall. I tucked my chin to save my neck and skull, but the impact drove the air from my lungs and stabbed me with daggers of pain. I heard Ghost utter a sharp cry as he crashed into the opposite wall. We both fell hard onto the juddering floor. He scrambled to his feet but stood quivering, his hair standing on end, eyes wild with terror. I lay there, dazed, my eyes filled with bright and painful lights. I spat brick dust, coughed too hard, and felt something burning in my chest. My ribs and shoulders were mashed, and each square inch felt like a separate volcano spewing red-hot lava. When I tried to get up, the next aftershock punched me into the wall so hard that my head chunked against the cracked plaster. All the lights winked out for a moment, and I fought my way back to consciousness, blinking a paste of dust and tears from my eyes. There was a high-pitched ringing in my ears. I lifted the 10,000 pounds of cracked block that was my head. And that's when the whole fucking day went sideways. The wall 10 feet in front of me seemed to shimmer and lose solidity, and for a moment I thought I was seeing the structural integrity disintegrate as vibrations turned brick and plaster to powder. That would have been bad enough. Yeah, that would have been bad. What I saw was worse. Chapter 116. Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia. The shimmer seemed to be shaped like an irregular crack, but it was clearly not part of the wall. Actually, that's wrong. I could see the regular wall, pushed back like a curtain. It was as if the wall was nothing more than an image painted on cloth and something was parting it. The cracks that had been there before were still visible, but rippled and pushed aside. And yes, I know how that sounds. I know how crazy it sounds. The shimmer was green, and as I watched, it became a deeper and more vibrant green. Luminescent, as if there was a powerful light beyond it and someone was turning a rheostat to make it brighter. Understand me, there was no light hanging on that wall, and I don't think this was light shining through it from another room. The hue was exactly like that of the broken gun and the guard's ring. It was exactly like the spikes in the tentacle or whatever it was in the lab. The same. An alien hue, like a shade of green that doesn't really fit into this world. My bruised head could not make sense of it, failing even to select the right adjectives to describe it internally. My heart began racing, and I sat there so startled that I did not even think of getting away. Ghost got to his feet and stood trembling, but then he began barking furiously at the green glow as he backed nervously away. Then there was a shadow within the shimmer. It was a figure, and it seemed to be moving inside the distortion, and in my semi-delirium, I wondered if maybe whatever was happening had indeed punched a hole into the next room, and this was one of the Russians trying to get out. That, you see, would make some sense. Panic flared, and I thought for a twisted moment that it was the rest of whatever that tentacle had belonged to. It wasn't either of those things. The moment, you see, was heading in a completely different direction, because the figure that stepped through the crack in the wall was not a Russian soldier, or one of the guys in dark suits, or a lab technician, or even a security guard, nor was he one of Echo Team come looking for me. Not a tentacular sea beast, either. The figure that stepped through the wall was tall. Very tall, at least 7 feet. He was dressed in some kind of strange and weirdly stylized body armor. It was as green as the shimmering light, but painted to look like scales. Darker green on its massive shoulders, arms, and legs, paler with yellowish horizontal plates across its chest and abdomen. The figure wore bizarre boots and gloves that were scaly and oversized, and each toe and finger ended in a thick, dark nail, or maybe claw? The intruder stopped and looked down at me. He wore a mask and helmet that, like the rest of its armor, was designed to look like the horned, knobbed, ridged face and skull of some kind of unnatural reptile. Instead of eyes, there were large goggles with lenses painted to resemble a lizard's slit-pupiled eyes. The mask had two slits for nostrils and a lipless slash of a mouth. He had on what looked like an old Apache breech clout made from tooled leather and covered with symbols I could not identify. Belts crisscrossed his hips, and there were objects in holsters whose nature and purpose were beyond my failing mind. Lying there, dazed and concussed, while the building shook itself to pieces around me, I stared up at the intruder and tried to understand what I was seeing. Clearly this was someone in a costume, in exotic body armor. I mean, really, what else could it be? Ghost kept barking and backing away, his tail tucked under his hip and eyes wild. The tension in his taut muscles told me that he wanted to run, to flee, but his need to protect his pack leader kept him there. He was losing it, though, and any second he was going to cross the line of pack mentality into pure survival mode. He'd flee, and I would be left staring at the man, if it was a man, who towered over me. I fumbled for my sidearm, but my holster was empty, the gun lost when Ghost attacked to keep me from blowing my own brains out. The big stranger looked down at the pieces of crystal on the floor. The tremor had scattered them around. If someone wearing a Halloween mask could frown, then that's what it looked like he did. He took a device from his belt and squatted down. I heard a whirr of a small motor and stared in frank astonishment as he vacuumed the green crystals up. He nodded to himself, stood, hung the vacuum on his belt, and drew an object from a holster and pointed it at me. It was unlike any gun I'd ever seen, if gun it was. It looked more like a flashlight with a pistol grip. The whole thing, body, handle, and bulb, was not made of metal or glass, but instead seemed to be made of some kind of that same green quartz. However, his device did not glow like the pistol had. Did that mean it was of a slightly different material, or was not, as Junie put it, activated? I had no way to know. No way to even properly theorize. The intruder thumbed a lever, and the gun suddenly glowed with a yellow-green light so intense that I winced and half turned away. Again, the light was not the same hue as before. He did not fire at me, but instead raised his weapon and aimed at the far wall. For one terrible moment, I thought he was going to shoot Ghost, and that snapped me halfway out of my daze. I snatched my Wilson rapid-release folding knife from its pocket, snapped the blade into place, and lunged at him. The blade flicked across his calf as he dodged away, but only the tip made contact, drawing a thin cut through his armor. He hissed like an iguana, and I froze, gaping at his legs. The body armor was bleeding. Green liquid, thick as blood, beaded up and ran in lines down his leg. That slammed me into absolute stillness. It was the same color as the green substance I'd seen on the injured closer in Maryland, not paint. Blood. The intruder rattled off something in a language I'd never heard before, wheeled, pointed his gun at the far wall, and pulled the trigger. There was another massive rumble, and once more the building seemed to shudder as if struck by some titanic fist. Overhead lights snapped loose and crashed to the floor, showering me with fragments of glass from the fluorescent tubes. I didn't care. I couldn't care because all my attention was fixed on the opposite wall. A new crack appeared, and it shimmered like the other one had, and once more the wall seemed to open and part like curtains on a stage. The intruder kept his gun pointed at it, the trigger pulled back until the crack widened enough for him to step through. I watched him go. I could see that the wavering crack was not really in the physical structure of the wall, but rather imposed upon it. Don't ask me how, because I was way beyond the capacity for rational thought. As the intruder vanished inside, I caught a glimpse, just the merest glimpse, of a different place. Not another room, not even the darkened parking lot outside. This was a rocky slope painted by bright sunlight that was the wrong color. More of a sickly sea green than yellow. Plants and flowers bloomed between the rocks, and I did not recognize a single one of them. They were towering ferns with leaves as long and sharp as swords, and something like a three-headed rose, its petals the color of fresh blood. Weeds lined with seed pods swayed in a wind that I did not feel. At the top of the slope was a building, a tower made from what looked like carnelian and red jasper, that rose into the sky. And the sky, dear God, that sky. There were two large moons and a dozen smaller ones partly obscured by wisps of clouds, and beyond all of them was the monstrous curve of a gas giant that swirled with storms like Jupiter, only more violent. Something flashed, a burst of green light that snapped like lightning from that alien sky and struck my chest with such force that I was picked up and smashed once more against the far wall. I managed to duck my head this time, but it didn't matter. The world went black, then green, then red. I dropped to my knees and felt like my head was cracking into 100 tiny pieces. Little bursts of color like crimson poppies blossomed in the air in front of my eyes, and when I looked down at my hands, I could see tendrils of electricity writhing and twisting on my gloves and up my arms. When I raised my head toward the impossible crack in the wall, it was gone. Bang! Just like that. The crack on that wall, and when I turned my aching head to look, the other one as well, leaving no trace at all of what I'd seen. I shook my head, trying to clear away the debris inside my skull. There were other cracks from the explosion or earthquake or whatever it was that was destroying the building, but no trace of the two cracks that had allowed the man in reptile-painted body armor to pass. If the armor was armor at all. If the man was a man at all. The last of the electricity faded out from my arms and I sagged back, gasping, my head hurting, my heart hammering. I dug into my pocket and pulled out the torn Faraday bag. The green crystal gun and the guard's ring lay there, shattered into fragments and dust. I peered close and saw that each piece was glowing as brightly as the wall had done a moment ago. Then it faded, 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 and went dark. No, almost dark. Deep inside of it there was a tiny spark of the green shimmer, but it looked strange. Like it wasn't so much small as very far away, which was, of course, impossible. Impossible. What in the holy hell just happened? What had I seen? What? Chapter 117. Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia. I got shakily to my feet. My balance was for shit, and I felt sick and stupid and strange. The committee of three in my head was silent for a change, as if they too were dazed and battered. Sounds were weird, too. I could hear the gunfire and yells from different parts of the building, but they sounded too far away, miles away, or maybe it was that my mind kept not wanting to hear them or care about them. My instincts kept yelling at me to pay attention to that, not to disregard what was going on, but to start damn well caring about it. There was a big trench opening up in the gulf between mind and heart, and too damn much of me wanted to lean so far over the edge that I'd fall. Then, as if from all the way at the far end of a football field, I heard Doc Holliday's words come echoing back.
If anyone on Echo Team displays even the slightest bit of unusual behavior, you need to disarm them immediately and get them out of the building.
Jesus Christ, I breathed. My head felt like a cracked egg. My nerves were shot, and I had no idea if I'd actually experienced and witnessed any of that, or if my brains were scrambled by trauma. The tremors were subsiding, but the building was a mess. Ghost came over and leaned against me, whining, needing comfort, as if I had any to give. I squatted down and wrapped my arms around him, sharing my reality with his. It was maybe cold comfort, but it was what we had. I felt tears burning in my eyes. My dog had saved me. He'd somehow understood what I was going to do, and he attacked me to save me. It was the smartest, bravest, most heartbreaking thing I've ever experienced. I hugged him and kissed his fur and wept as he whined and tried to lick me. Then, slowly, slowly, I got to my feet. The floor was buckled and cracked, but it was solid. There were no dark winds blowing, no shadows in my mind. They had gone when the green man had taken the crystals away. Junie was right, as she was often right. Doc Holliday might be a hardcore scientist, but she was going to have to embrace a wider definition of things now that she was working with the DMS. The stuff we encountered was often outside the box of science as she knew it, sometimes way outside, and Junie was likely to be her guide. After all, Junie's DNA was proof that we are not alone. No, not alone. The green man could have killed me. He did not. And as I thought about that, the memory of what the closers on the road in Maryland said came back with a lot more force and clarity. We are not your enemy. I licked brick dust and tears from my lips and nodded as I walked over to the far wall. There was a slender crack caused by the explosion, if it was an explosion, and I had my doubts, but it was less than a finger's width apart. Everything around it was solid and showed no other evidence of what I'd seen. The opposite wall was the same, only a crack that a baby mouse couldn't squeeze through. Then there was another rumble way down deep beneath my feet, and I could feel the vibration through the soles of my shoes. It was distant, though, farther away. More explosions? No, I didn't think so. Not explosions. The God machine was down there, and the earth was trembling. That wasn't difficult math for me to understand. I tapped my earbud.
Echo team?
I said, tripping over it.
Report.
Top came on the line and used an executive code to isolate the call.
Where's your head at, cowboy?
Exposed to green quartz, I said. I'm clear now.
How sure are you?
Sure.
Okay, then,
he said slowly and put the whole team on the call.
Listen up, cowboy got dosed by the green quartz shit. He says he's clear, but nobody takes chances with anybody. Do you copy?
He said it harsh and hard, and they all responded with passion. No one offered sympathy or support for me, because that's not how it's done. Later, maybe, we'd all get drunk over it. Now we had to survive.
Give me a sit rep,
I said, fighting to keep the shakes out of my voice. There was a jumble of responses, and I heard pain in every voice. Every single one of them checked in. A few dents, but no real injuries. No casualties, at least on our side. Thank God for that.
Cowboy?
Demanded Cole.
What happened to the building? Was that a bomb?
I think it was another goddamn earthquake, I answered. There's a God machine in the sub-basement, and I think it somehow went active.
Continue exfiltration, I ordered. Then I closed out of the team channel and got Bug on the line.
Kid, tell me you guys all saw what just happened.
Cowboy,
he began, but stalled. The fact that his first question wasn't saw what was a total gut punch. Before he could say more, another voice broke into the call.
Cowboy, this is the Deacon. We saw everything your body cam showed us. Are you in immediate danger from the person you just encountered?
No. No, I don't think so, I said uncertainly. But I don't know what the hell it was.
Instead of answering, Church said, Get your team out of that building by any means necessary. Do it right now.
A new rumble shook the building and the floor canted under me. I grabbed the doorknob and jerked it open just as yet another massive jolt shook the whole building, bigger than the first two. Ghost went skidding past me, his nails scraping lines all the way to the wall. He barked angrily, but at what? The building? The earth? God? I heard Duffy yelling over the shared line.
Echo team, part of the south wall just collapsed. I think part of the parking lot's collapsing. Oh, shit, a fucking sinkhole just opened up in the parking lot. Everyone get out of the building right now.
Right now was a problem, though, because the building may have been falling the hell down, but it was also filled with a bunch of guys trying to shoot us.
Christ.
Ghost and I, weak and battered and sick as we were, ran down the stairs to join the fight. Chapter 118. The Orb at the Hangar, Floyd Bennett Field, Brooklyn, New York. Doc Holliday and Junie Flynn stood in a factory in Russia without ever leaving New York. On one of the big screens, they watched the feeds from Echo Team's body cams as they moved through the shipping warehouse and rooms filled with manufacturing machines. The individual pieces were absorbed by a mind reader engineering program that applied design logic software and assembled the pieces. The software relied as much on its deep database of existing machinery as the imperative logic of a computer. The pieces could only fit together in so many possible ways, and the quantum system calculated hundreds of thousands of possibilities. Juni watched holograms of the various pieces turn this way and that and then fly together, and moment by moment, she could feel her heart race faster and faster and her blood turn to ice. She knew what was coming. When she caught a look at Doc, it was clear the scientist did too. Neither of them liked it. Both of them were terrified at the possibility, at the reality. Calpurnia, speaking for mind reader, spoke so calmly as to be intensely unnerving.
"Assembly complete," said the soft, feminine AI voice. "Pushkin Dynamics is manufacturing and shipping God machines."
Chapter 119. Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia. Doc called and told me the bad news. The scary news. The more she told me, the scarier it got. "How many?" I asked, not really wanting an answer. I was working my way along a hallway that was cracked and choked with debris. Clouds of dust filled the air.
"It's bad. Estimating the contents of the crates in the shipping bay? Maybe 600.
I closed my eyes.
"These are the small ones,"
she said, trying to sound hopeful and failing. The small ones were what they used in D.C. "How many were sent to the States? More than were used in D.C.?"
"We can't tell yet."
"Try harder," I snarled and disconnected from the call. 600 God machines in the shipping bay. Good Lord. So many questions caught fire in my head. How many had they already made? How many had been shipped? And to where? Was D.C. only the first of a series of attacks? "Yes," I said aloud, and my voice echoed eerily. I looked around and saw only damage. That felt like a statement about life in general. Whatever was happening here, an earthquake, a God machine coming to life, or maybe something as mundane and comforting as a freaking bomb, the building had taken a real beating. The walls and floor were crisscrossed with cracks, and there was nothing left in the windows but broken teeth of glass. Cold wind blew in from outside, turning the swirling dust into frigid ghosts. The rumbling stopped again, and now there was a heavy silence, but I did not buy the implied lie that it was over. That orderly process was getting its ass kicked by memories of a guy dressed like a reptile, walking out of walls and walking into walls. That was seriously scrambling my head, and I had no idea in hell what I was going to do with that. There was sporadic gunfire from several different parts of the building, and then Bunny called.
"Green Giant to Spartan, be advised, Bravo Squad's coming out, but we don't want to walk into a shooting gallery. We could use some covering fire."
Duffy's reply was, yeah, don't tell your grandma how to suck eggs. Despite everything, he was trying to sound normal, cool and confident. It was a soldier's trick, a battlefield version of fake it till you make it. But the cracks in his voice were as evident as those in the walls. Even so, I heard two spaced shots accompanied by the sound of shattering glass, then a third shot. "No one's waiting outside the door, kids," he said dryly.
"What about the parking lot?" asked Bunny.
"They left four men outside to guard the vehicles," said Duffy. "Mind you step over the bodies."
"A-team is pinned down in the loading bay," called Cole. "Count 20-plus hostiles between us and the door, guards and staff, and all of them acting crazy."
"B-team is in the same shed, boss," said Bunny. "We're about to get swarmed. No way we're getting through this without putting civilians down."
I took a breath in through my flaring nostrils and ground my teeth.
"There are no civilians in here. This is a target-rich environment. You are free to go, weapons hot, weapons all. Get out of the building by any means necessary."
I heard Tate's bass thunder of laugh.
"Then hold on to your nutsacks, kids, because it's about to get loud in here."
And by that we all knew he was about to unlock Doc Holliday's toy box. Bunny and Tate hunkered down behind a row of file cabinets as a bunch of Russians ran through the darkened office suite. There was no plan or coordination to the movement of the hostiles, and Bunny could see three distinct types of enemy: men and women in lab coats, upper floor security personnel, and soldiers.
"Where are all the lab guys coming from?"
murmured Tate.
"Thermals said there were only guards in here."
"Gotta be shielded labs like the ones Cowboy found,"
said Bunny.
"No way to know how many cockroaches are going to come out of the woodwork."
He shifted around to look into Tate's eyes.
"You ready to do this?"
The bravado Tate had used when on the team channel was just that. The reality of using deadly force against people who were clearly under the influence of some kind of strange technology, and many of them civilians, was the kind of thing that could cripple a soldier. It could also make a soldier freeze or hesitate. Or it could go the other way and turn a horror show into something approaching entertainment. None of those outcomes was good. The balaclava hid Tate's mouth, but from the way the material moved, it was clear Tate was licking his lips. Dry mouth. Fear. Yeah.
"I'm good to go, Green Giant,"
said the big former cop.
"You sure?"
"I'm good,"
Tate said. They studied each other for a moment longer, and then Bunny gave him a single slow nod.
"Then let's do this and go home."
Tate pivoted on the balls of his feet and peered around the edge of their shelter. A pack of the madmen were coming their way.
"Fire in the hole,"
said Tate as he reached for the buttons on his wrist computer. He didn't yell it, though. It was like he was telling himself to brace for what was coming. The blast and fire chased all shadows from the room.
"Sergeant Rock," cried Cole. "On your six."
Top ducked, spun, and fired as a bearded man in a lab coat swung a heavy fire axe. The blade whistled 3 inches over his head as three rounds from Top's gun punched neat red holes in the attacker's chest. The axe, released from dying fingers, thumped hard between Top's shoulder blades and drove him down hard on his knees.
"Stay down,"
Cole yelled as she fired over him at two other attackers, catching them dead center in the sternum. Then she caught Top under the shoulder and hauled him to his feet.
"Are you hurt?"
"Who cares?"
he growled as he turned to cut down a pair of soldiers with submachine guns. I heard Bug in my ear as I ran toward the sounds of battle.
"Cowboy, the building's coming apart."
"No shit," I said, as I jumped across a 4-foot-wide split in the floor that widened further as I cleared it. Ghost barked furiously and then ran and leaped across. I snaked out a hand and caught his harness and hauled him to safety.
"Listen," said Bug urgently. "The cracks in the structure are allowing the thermal scans to get a better picture of the sublevels. There are 5 big rooms, labs or machine shops or something. There are more than 100 new thermal signatures. There are a lot of people down there."
The screams and gunfire that spiraled out of the closest stairwell made it sound like a war zone.
"No shit," I said again.
Pete Smith ran through shadows, moving from one parked car to the other, working his way around to a covering position on the back door. He froze as one of the SUVs came rolling up and stopped outside, blocking the exit. 6 heavily armed men piled out, each of them dressed in nondescript black. They left the engine running and closed on the door. Peter could hear them talking in Russian, but he did not much understand the language, and he was too far away for his mind reader Link to capture and translate it. So Smith edged forward, staying low and out of sight. One of the newcomers spoke to the others with a clear voice of authority. He caught a terse order given by the leader in a clear voice.
"Ubit vzik. Kill them all."
"Well, boys," murmured Pete to himself, "you called this play."
He took a fragmentation grenade from a pouch on his belt, pulled the pin, counted, and threw. He had done this 1,000 times playing Call of Duty. He'd done this in training countless times. M69 practice grenades in non-lethal drills, live ones on a throwing range. He tossed stun grenades on the job working SWAT in North Carolina. This was the first time he had ever thrown a real grenade at real people. He twisted down and back behind the vehicle. There was a thump. 2 men shouted warnings at once. Too late. And then the blast. His grenade landed in the middle of the tight knot of soldiers. The man most distant from it was no more than 6 feet away. From the time the spoon was released, there were 5 seconds before it exploded. The men tried to scatter. The injury radius of the M67 is 49 feet. The fatality radius is 16 feet. All of the men were too close for any chance at all. They were blown apart, lifted, scattered, flash-burned, ruined. When Smith leaned out and looked through the smoke, what he saw did not resemble anything that had ever been human. It was the first time in his life he had killed. He knew, even as he moved out of cover and ran for the door, that he had just been marked. He knew he had crossed a line for which there was no going back, no do-overs, no absolution. He was now, and always would be, a killer. He could feel his heart shift inside his chest as he ran.
"I'm sorry,"
he said as he ran through blood and stepped over torn legs and shredded skin.
"I'm sorry."
The blast had punched the door inward, half-tearing it from the hinges. Smith raised his leg and kicked, once, twice, three times, and then the hinges snapped and it canted in and then fell with a monstrous clang. Smith paused for one moment and almost looked down at the blood on the ground and at the parts around him. He almost made that mistake. He did not, though. That marked him too, but in a different way. Steve Duffy had a perfect elevated shooting position from which he could see most of the parking lot and nearly all of the arriving hostiles. Nine of them lay still on the ground and the rest had scattered. Duffy's rifle had a flash suppressor and a high-tech silencer to make tracking him difficult, and he could control the pigeon drones to emit flashes and digital recordings of gunshots from various points in the area. It was easy enough to time them, so they flashed and banged as he pulled his trigger. That made the bad guys keep looking in the wrong direction. Duffy had suggested this to Doc Holliday and was delighted when she made it happen and implemented it for all field team snipers. There were rabid drones that could do the same thing. In order to accommodate a speaker with enough fidelity for a loud bang, the drone had to be at least that big. Horseflies were too small. All he had to do to trigger a distraction was tap a sensor with the little finger of his left hand, leaving the other fingers to steady his rifle and keeping his right hand completely free. Easy as pie. Duffy believed himself to be a good man, even-tempered, easy to get along with, generally happy. He held very little animosity in his soul and did not even particularly hate the men who were pouring in to try and kill his colleagues. They were a problem to be solved. Angle and elevation, tactics and strategy, cause and effect. He was not a philosopher and tended not to brood. As he saw it, these guys put on targets when they put on their uniforms, and they made those targets glow in the dark when they rolled in here. Sucked to be them. The newcomers had stayed outside since arriving, but now they raced for the doors, opening them and pouring inside.
"Oh, crap," murmured Duffy.
He triggered another drone and fired at just the right time. His bullet punched through the chest of one man in black and blew a hole the size of an apple out of his back. The shot had been placed slightly off-center so as to spin the target. Duffy triggered another flash and bang at once, but did not fire, letting the noise and light turn every eye that way. The men in black opened up on a patch of empty darkness. Duffy called into Echo Team to tell them that there were new hostiles in the building.
"I don't think they're affected by that green crystal shit, guys. Heads up. I'll see if I can thin the herd."
Duffy killed another of them. And another. He triggered four drones at once, and the men scattered, thinking there was a kill team in the bushes on the wrong side of the parking lot. In his head, the Queen song, "Another One Bites the Dust," played over and over again on a continuous loop. The toy box had a cute name, but it was a monster. Bunny and Tate shifted around to watch what happened. Hardened as Bunny was, what he saw chilled him to the bone. Two of the soldiers in black, the ones Duffy warned them about, charged into the room, yelling in Russian for everyone to stand down and throw down their weapons. One of the wild scientists rushed at them with a knife in his raised fist, but the soldiers cut him down without hesitation. Then they opened fire on everyone else. More of the soldiers came into the room, guns ready. The room was dark, and they never saw the fishing line strung across the passage between a row of desks and a file cabinet. It broke easily, and there was a flash of tiny silver flechettes whipping through the air, and then three soldiers went down, their faces slashed to red ruin. They landed hard, and their screams stopped all at once. The flechettes were smeared with botulinum toxin type H, the deadliest neurotoxin available. You do not get clumsy fingered around that stuff. The soldiers were probably dead before they landed. One Russian who'd seen them fall waved off a second man, and they backpedaled and cut to their right to skirt the area and ran straight into a spider web, an ultra-thin filament that is nearly invisible even in good light. It wrapped around their torsos, and the explosive chemicals in the woven strands combined and detonated, blowing one man in half and setting the other one's clothes on fire. The modified thermite burned into his chest and groin and thighs, and what was left of him collapsed in a fiery heap, arteries exploding in geysers of red. It was ugly, but it was fast. 5 men in 3 seconds. Bunny and Tate crabbed sideways to the end of a row of cabinets, then broke for the door. The soldiers spun toward their movement, but Tate twisted as he ran and hurled what looked like a string of popcorn behind him. The kernels exploded with a white light so intense that the soldiers screamed and staggered and blundered through more of the tripwires. Bunny grabbed Tate and shoved him through the door as fire and screams filled the room. Then someone came out of nowhere and tried to take Bunny with a burst of automatic gunfire, but the big young man had been ready. He jagged right and opened up with his heavy MPS AA-12 drum-fed combat shotgun loaded with explosive pellets. The first round hit the attacker center mass and blew him apart, Kevlar notwithstanding. Bunny spun as 3 more of the Russians swarmed him from close range. They hadn't fired because their man had been between them and Bunny, but as that guy fell, the first Russian slammed shoulder first into Bunny. The attacker was a brute who looked like he could bench press a grizzly, but Bunny twisted and sloughed the impact off and used the chunky stock of his shotgun to crush the back of the Russian's head. Bunny whirled as the other two brought their rifles up, but suddenly Pete Smith was there. He carried guns, but he preferred knives for close work and had a matched set of Marine K-bars in his gloved fists. The 7-inch blades whipped across arms and faces and throats, and Smith walked between the falling bodies to check on Bunny and Tate.
"Lead the way, brother," said Tate, relieved to see his friend.
"Can't," said Smith, moving off to the left.
"I got outlaws on my back trail. We need to find Alpha Team and get out through the loading bay." "This is going south on us fast," Tate grumbled.
"Welcome to Echo Team," said Bunny, and fell in behind the others, walking backward fast, his shotgun ready.
There was the sound of running feet from the direction Smith had come, and he did not think it was the cavalry.
Go, go, go!
Chapter 120. Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia. I paused at the entrance to the stairwell and watched the drama play out on my wrist computer. All of my team were fighting for their lives. I felt pride for the way they handled themselves, for their efficiency and skill and courage. I felt fear in an equal measure. Alpha and Bravo squads both needed my help, but Bravo had the toy box and Alpha did not, so I ran for the loading bay. Ghost barked a warning that was immediately drowned out as a huge chunk of the ceiling in the stairwell dropped down with a murderous thud. Then I heard and felt the grumble of protesting timbers, and the cough of shattering concrete as another tremor, heavier than the others, punched and kicked its way through the building. It rose up from beneath me and tried to pull the whole building down. The tremor ended, but there was a tension buzzing in the air, and I did not for a minute believe this was over. I tapped to the command channel. "Bug, kill the lights. Sergeant Rock, I'm on my way. Be there ASAP. Watch for me on your 6. A second later, the whole place went absolutely dark. I slipped on a pair of the Google Tactical Military Scout glasses that had been designed by one of Mr. Church's friends in the industry, expressly for covert special ops use. I set the controls to night vision, and then Ghost and I went hunting in the dark. The shadows were filled with wild gunfire, but the bad guys didn't know where to look or who was in there with them. Top and Cole immediately shifted position per our training patterns. They would have their night vision on, too. I saw them moving from behind cover. Security lights flashed on, but Cole punched them out with 3 fast, precise shots. It seemed like there was an army of killers between me, Top, and Cole, and the door. We could see in the dark, though. They could not. Bunny, Tate, and Smith came in from a side door, and then it was all of Echo Team against five times our number. Long story short, we killed them all. Chapter 121. Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia. Duffy stared through the scope and tried to understand what he was seeing. The sky was growing intensely dark, as it often did right before dawn, but there were stars up there. Except the stars were moving. They weren't shooting stars either. They moved with an eerie grace just above the horizon. Three of them in a perfect geometric formation. A triangle.
No,
breathed Duffy as he realized what he was seeing. There had been training videos and photos in DMS case files, but he had never actually seen a T-craft before. He didn't want to see one now. It came closer. Lower. It was wrong, somehow. It was too big, for one thing. The machines Howard Shelton had built were only a little larger than F-16s. This one was five times as big. And the three lights, one on each wingtip, which he had mistaken for the last stars of a fading night, were no longer white. No, they cycled through white to yellow, and now they burned with a brilliant, luminous green. The T-craft moved toward the building in a dreadful silence. That twisted Duffy's brain because it seemed impossible for something so large to be so quiet. It was like something in a dream. Or a nightmare. The green lights pulsed once, twice, and then every car in the parking lot seemed to judder and dance as if they were somehow coming alive. They were not. Duffy knew that because he, too, was trembling. It was the ground. It was another earthquake, and Duffy knew with absolute clarity that it wasn't the god machine Captain Ledger saw in the basement causing this destruction. It was the T-craft. Chapter 122. Pushkin Dynamics, Vostochny District, Russia.
Spartan the Cowboy?
Duffy yelled in a voice that had risen past alarm to actual panic.
You need to get out of there right fucking now. Half the damn building's coming down.
He was wrong about that. It was the whole damn building. The rumble swelled to thunder, and suddenly the walls seemed to shiver, shedding pieces of masonry and plaster like a dog shaking water off its coat. I heard a sharp sound within that roar and saw a massive chunk of the ceiling tear loose.
Top!
I screamed, but Cole was already in motion, hurling herself atop with a flying tackle that caught the older man around the waist and drove him backward. They fell together and rolled, bumping on the ground with elbows and knees as 10 tons of wood, steel, and debris whumped down exactly where Top had been. I saw Tate push Bunny and Smith away as a stack of wooden crates toppled and fell. The crates exploded on impact, and pieces of god machines went skittering across the floor.
Out! Out!
I yelled, but everyone was already running for the loading bay door as more cracks snapped their way across the ceiling. Behind me, Ghost gave a sharp bark of alarm and warning, and I spun to see him leap forward as the floor gaped like the mouth of some hungry monster. Gas and dust belched upward, and for a moment I couldn't tell whether Ghost got clear or was swallowed whole. Panic flared in my chest, but then a white bulk sprang through the veil of dust and landed beside me, nails skittering on the broken floor.
"Cowboy!" bellowed Top. "Side door!"
I spun to see him and Cole at the exit. She was fighting the lock.
"There's something wrong with the lock," she said. "Give me a second."
Top pushed her aside, tensed, and gave the door a savage kick. Top is as experienced a martial artist as I am, and he put every ounce of his considerable muscular mass and power, along with a metric ton of fear, into that kick. The door, however, barely budged. As I ran toward them, I saw Top assess the frame, and I could see what he saw. The earthquake had twisted the frame out of true, and the metal security door was wedged there. He turned and looked at the other exits, but debris was raining down in front of them, and there was no time for a blaster plaster. It was kick the door or get buried alive.
"Well, fuck you and your mama, too!"
he roared as he gave the door a second kick, a third. Then I was there, and we kicked it together. Once, twice, three times. On the fourth kick, the door did not open. Instead, the whole wall simply cracked apart and collapsed backward away from us in huge chunks.
"Jesus Christ," said Cole. "You boys sure know how to impress a lady."
Top and I exchanged a wild grin. We knew we hadn't done it. The building was dying. But it was funny in the way things are funny to soldiers in the heat of battle. Cole ran past us with Ghost at her heels. Top and I leaped after her, and not a moment too soon, because the rest of the ceiling came down with such a tremendous clap of thunder that the force picked us all up and hurled us into the parking lot. I tucked and rolled as I landed, but there was so much impetus that I rolled three times before I could get to my feet, and even then I pitched into a stumbling run. Ghost flew like an overgrown underdog past me, yelped on impact, but did not fall. When I turned to see how Top and Cole were, they ran past me and skidded to a stop. We stared in horror as Pushkin Dynamics collapsed amid clouds of dust that was peppered with debris. I looked around but could not see anyone else. Bunny and Tate came staggering and coughing out of the smoke to our left. Smith came running around from the right, his weapon up and ready. Then, other figures emerged. Five of the Russians who had been inside the building, two of them raised weapons. Smith put one down, and a bullet from Duffy exploded the other one's head. The three remaining Russians bolted and ran. One of them looked up in the sky and screamed. We looked up, too. I heard Cole and Tate cry out. Smith hissed like he'd been burned, and Ghost began barking wildly. Top, Bunny, and I merely stared. There, hovering in ghastly silence above the building, was the largest T-craft I'd ever seen. It was massive, and the three glowing lights on its wings pulsed with that awful, familiar green. In the first hint of dawn, I could see a faint shimmer in the air beneath the craft. At first, I thought it was the anti-gravity drive, but then I understood. "Run!" I yelled. We ran. We ran like maniacs. The deepest, loudest rumble yet made me turn back just in time to see what was left of Pushkin Dynamics crumble and fall into a massive sinkhole that kicked up a towering whirlwind of dust. Huge chunks of the parking lot snapped off and dropped down, too, and as I turned to run, I caught the faintest hint of a glow from deep inside the cloud. Not the red or orange of fire, and not the blue of burning gas. No, this was that same eerie green glow. It was there, and then it was gone, totally obscured by the dust clouds. We ran so hard and so fast, but the ground seemed intent on devouring us. SUVs tilted and rolled down. Trees snapped off and fell. The air was filled with thunder and dust and death. A great geyser of water shot up from a ruptured main and hammered down on us. There was a different kind of roar, and I saw one of the SUVs, the one Echo Team had arrived in, racing toward us. It spun into a skidding, screeching turn and stopped, and I could see a wild-eyed Duffy behind the wheel. We piled in, and Duffy was moving before the doors were closed, his foot welding the gas pedal to the floor. We blew past the other Russian SUVs, and Tate whipped an arm out of the window to deliver some going-away presents. As our car sped away, I craned my neck to see a ball of black-veined orange lift the cars and hurl them at the trees, which immediately burst into flame. The earthquake tried to kill us. It tried. But we erupted from the lot and onto the street and fled into the dawn. Chapter 123 DMS Safe House, undisclosed location, near Moscow. Duffy parked behind the safe house and left the key in the ignition. Someone would come and take the SUV away to be sanitized, repainted, and sold in a legitimate used car lot. Two new cars were parked nearby, and the keys for those were on the kitchen table. We closed all the curtains, made coffee, made food, and sat in the kitchen without touching any of it. Lots of staring, lots of eyes not making contact. Except for Bunny and Top, who glanced significantly at each other and covertly at me.
Eventually, the others looked my way, too. It was a weird moment. We all had what felt like gallons of adrenaline supercharging our blood, and if they were anything like me, it was triggering more of the flight-than-fight response. And it was Duffy who broke the silence. He held his hand up to his head, little finger and thumb splayed to mimic talking on the phone. "Hi, Mom. How was my day? Oh, you know, the usual. Alien lizard guys in spaceships." We all cracked up. Fist thumping, eyes running with tears, coughing and choking laughter. It happens like that sometimes. When it faded, it left us giddy, which was all nerves. Smith raised his hand like a schoolboy. "Ask it," I said. "Can I be excused and go back to the real world?" "No, next question."
"Then, okay," said Tate. "We got all this weird shit going on, and I'm going to need therapy for like 10 years, but what does it mean? How's it all fit together? Does it even make sense?"
I turned my chair around backward and leaned my forearms on the backsplat. "It makes sense," I said. "Let me fill in the blanks of what you don't know, and then I want you to explain it back to me." I went over every detail, starting from the Secret Service coming after me at the cemetery. I backtracked to hit the highlights of the extinction machine and kill switch cases. I told them what Doc and Junie told me. I gave them everything I had from Bug and Nikki. I told them about Violin and Harry, all of it. It took a while. We ate scrambled eggs and toast and drank 3 pots of coffee. The morning burned on, chasing away the Moscow chill. Birds sang in the trees and the world turned, as if everything was normal. When I was done, we had another long time of silence. I could see their eyes shifting to look inward at their own thoughts. I could hear gears turning. They were professionals, even the newbies. This was what the DMS was all about, and they were each members of Echo Team for a reason, and that meant it ran much deeper than their skills in a firefight. They were all smart, and they possessed insight and intuition. Useful tools for this kind of work. "So," I said, "talk to me."
"We need to get home," said Cole. "They shipped a lot more God machines than they used in D.C.
"Yeah," said Tate, nodding. "If they hit us once, they're going to hit us again."
"It's more than that," said Top, and everyone looked at him. "Those guys in the T-craft ain't joking. These God machines belong to them every bit as much as the Majestic Black Book did. Valen and the Russians may have trashed Washington, but it was the original owners of that tech who shoved Pushkin down the drain. One of them saw you, Capman. If they're the same cats we saw on the road in Maryland, then they're trying to make a point. They told us they weren't our enemies, but they aren't our friends, neither. They let us get out of the building. That was them making a point."
Smith frowned. "What point?" "Give us back our toys and do it right damn quick," I said. "Don't think they're going to give us a third chance." Top nodded. So, after a moment, did everyone else. Chapter 124. The Hangar, Floyd Bennett Field, Brooklyn, New York. Bug had a large team, one that grew faster than any other department within the DMS. Cyberterrorism and cybercrime were the greatest threat to governments around the world since the creation of atomic weapons, and far more insidious. They could cause incredible destruction without scorching the earth or irradiating the air, and the weapon of choice in the 21st century was a laptop with good Wi-Fi. Bug was on the other side of that battlefield. He, like many of his employees, had begun his career as a gray hat hacker. Some of his people had actually been black hats, though when faced with a choice of using their skills to help rather than harm, had made sensible choices. Others Bug had tried to recruit hadn't made the right call, and they were in prison cells, denied any access to computers. This did not mean that Bug and his people respected laws. That was hardly the case. They routinely committed felonies of all kinds. The difference was the reason. For Bug and his department, it was very much a philosophy of the ends justifying the means.
When he forwarded requests through proper channels to initiate a nationwide search for the male identified as Valen Ororaka, a suspected Russian agent, his request was denied. The refusal came down from the highest office in the land and was front-loaded with a blistering reprimand and all manner of threats should the Department of Military Sciences try to hijack already overtaxed systems for a wild goose hunt, and various words to that effect. The doors of free and unfettered access to the various databases of the American intelligence networks were slammed in his face.
"Fine," said Bug. "Be that way."
He called a brief meeting with his department heads and told them what he wanted them to do. None of the people in the meeting looked particularly dangerous. An outsider might label them geeks or nerds. Those labels were fair enough. However, they were very dangerous geeks and nerds. They were, in their way, every bit as dangerous as Joe Ledger, Top, Bunny, or any of the shooters who went into the field. None of Bug's team carried a gun. Most wouldn't know how to even load one. They didn't need to. They had Mind Reader Q1.
"Find Valen Ororaka," said Bug. "No mercy."
The no mercy thing was an unwritten in-house protocol. It meant that the full power of the world's most powerful, sophisticated, and subtle computer system, with all of its super intrusion software, would be aimed at those closed doors and the trigger pulled. The vast databases of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security never saw them coming. They did, however, brace for an attack because the White House told them to expect some kind of trickery from the DMS. They looked, but they did not see the bullet. Neither did the CIA, the DIA, the Secret Service, or any of the dozens of other departments and agencies in the collective law enforcement, intelligence, and investigative community. Mind Reader Q1 walked past all of their watchdog programs, invisible and unfelt. It accessed trillions of files and rewrote the host software to erase even the slightest trace of its presence. No footprint was left, no echo, no scar. Bug's intercom buzzed and he punched the button.
"Thrill me," he said.
"On your screen,"
said Delilah, one of his best gunslingers. An image appeared, showing a man with black hair, a goatee, Wayfarer sunglasses, and a cowboy hat, walking into a convenience store attached to a gas station across from the Econo Lodge in Livingston, Montana. The black-and-white surveillance cameras got good views of him from three different angles. He wore bootcut jeans and a Western-style shirt. The boots had thick soles and thicker heels. He did not look remotely like the man they were hunting. Bugs smiled anyway. He bent close and looked at a dozen pop-up windows that overlaid the video feed. Minute measurements of ears, cheekbones, nose, and other features flashed as they lined up with the college identification photo of Valen Ororaka.
"Got you, you son of a bitch," murmured Bug.
Part 3. Hot time in the old town tonight. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. The Second Coming. William Butler Yeats. Chapter 125. In Flight Over Canadian Airspace.
"Cowboy,"
said Bug via the command channel,
"the pilot says you're not going to Montana."
"No," I said. "I'm going hunting for Valen Ororaka."
"But Valen's in Montana,"
insisted Bug. "Maybe," I said, "but that's not where he's going." Doc Holliday said,
"Activating the orb. I think we need to have us a little powwow."
Suddenly she was there with Junie, Church, and Bug, along with my whole team. Before I explain where I'm going, I want to go over some things. Let's take this one piece at a time. Honest opinion, guys, is Valen our big bad?
"No," said Bug. "It's Gadyuka."
"I agree,"
said Junie.
"Valen is a scientist and an idealist. He's fighting for a cause." Two causes, really, this new Soviet thing and family. He thinks his uncle was unfairly blamed for Chernobyl. It's been the focus of his whole life to learn enough to be able to prove what he believes.
He's still a bad guy, though, said Bunny. Heartbreak or not, he's just killed nearly 2,000 people.
2,109 as of this morning,
corrected Doc. That hurt. It really goddamn hurt. I saw Top wince. Cole turned away, unable to look at anyone for a moment. Let me change the question, I said. Is Gadyuka the big bad?
Yes,
said Bug.
Yes,
said Doc and Junie.
No, said Church.
Gadyuka is a spymaster and possibly an assassin, but the setup at Pushkin Dynamics could not exist without substantial political juice. Someone had to authorize the money for it, make sure it was left alone, guarantee that the tax returns would not be looked at too closely, and grease the wheels for the exports. That takes an infrastructure of considerable size. Gadyuka seems more likely as the director of field operations, but I can't buy her as being senior management. It would be too risky to run an op of that size from the field. That, for the record, is why I do not go into the field anymore. Any chain of command needs to be solidly anchored.
Doc frowned for a moment.
When you say infrastructure, you're not talking about Russian mafia? Do you mean a ghost organization within the Russian government?
Church shrugged.
That, or something bigger.
What's bigger?
Began Bunny, then he stopped and goggled.
Wait, you're talking about all the way big, aren't you? Like the actual Russian government. Are we talking Uncle Vladimir as the big bad?
Anything is possible, Master Sergeant, I said.
No way something like this was happening without key people at the very top being involved. The risk is too big, for one thing. If a single shred of proof ever gets out connecting Russia to D.C., then it's an act of war. Such an event would splinter all global alliances. Countries would have to decide if they wanted to move fast to help crush Russia completely to prevent the use of the earthquake weapon, or they might align themselves with the new Soviet for fear of devastating retaliation. We have proof that Pushkin was shipping, or planning to ship, those machines to China, England, and other countries.
Well, we have the shipping records from a building that no longer exists,
corrected Bug.
That's not going to be enough for declarations of war. We're going to have to be careful how we break this. I agree, said Junie. This news is like a nuclear bomb. Last thing we want is politicians overreacting and demanding that we put missiles in the air. For the record, guys, said Bug, I'm not a fan of that whole mutually assured destruction thing. I've seen those movies. First bombs, then giant radioactive cockroaches and gorillas on horseback with carbines. No thanks.
He's right, said Junie. As much as I'm usually for full disclosure, there is no way to spin this that wouldn't result in a panic, or a war, or both.
Can't let it go unanswered, said Top.
No, agreed Church.
Who do we tell?
Asked Doc.
Last I heard, everyone in Washington was hanging up on you.
First things first, I said. Valen is still out there. Bug, have you been able to decrypt the shipping records? How many god machines were sent to America?
Well, Bug said, some of it is still rough guesses, and not all of the shipments went to the United States. But if you include Canada, to places where there's a lot of interstate trucking heading down to the States, then it's a lot of them. Possibly as few as 80 and as many as 200.
200, cried Cole.
Maybe more, said Bug. It breaks down like this. 50 of them were sent to Baltimore via container ships. The dockyard records show them coming in from 3 different points of origin, none of which are Russia. The shipments were moved around a lot. Any customs computer whiz would have missed it because the guys at Pushkin were very smart about it, but, you know, mind reader and all. So that accounts for all of the DC machines and maybe some others as backups or defective. There are no records at all after they were picked up by local trucking companies and delivered to a warehouse in Baltimore. They were probably picked up from there by Valen and his crew. The warehouse has been swept and is clean.
Big question, said Doc. But where'd the rest of the galdang machines go?
5 different ports in Western Canada coming from all sorts of fake destinations, but I can prove they started at Pushkin.
The cargo was picked up by truckers and came into the U.S. via the standard routes through Canada, Route 99, to Route 5 in Washington, and then west along 90, and probably south on 15.
That means we can track them, said Duffy. Good, let's roadblock these sons of bitches.
Bug, tell them the complications. Bug sighed. First thing is that most of the parts shipments were sent to their destinations months ago. Not sure how long it takes to assemble one of these god machines, but from our experience with Gateway and Prospero Bell, it's tricky. There are all sorts of alignment issues, and you really don't want to get the math wrong.
Assuming they know how to build them, said Top, what's the timetable?
I think the clock's ticking down to boom, I said. Bug spotted Valen in Montana. I think he's out there to oversee the next phase. But before we get to that, let's backtrack and add the other big piece of the puzzle, the why.
About that, said Cole. What's his beef with us? Unless I skip that day in history class, we didn't sabotage Chernobyl.
She glanced at Church.
Did we?
No, said Church. We did not sabotage Chernobyl.
Then why did he wreck Washington? And why is he out there maybe setting up some other attack?
Why did the Soviet Union collapse? Asked Church. Cole thought about it.
It was economics, wasn't it? Trying to keep up with us, building up their military and all that. We have more natural resources and a stronger economy.
Top marks, said Church. I'm sure if he'd actually been in the same room with us, he'd have given her a cookie. There were other elements, but as is often the case, it comes down to money. We have more of it, and we used it more effectively. There was tremendous economic turmoil, poverty, corruption, and internal strife in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. We prospered and even offered financial aid, which seemed like compassion and forgiveness, but wasn't. It never is in such circumstances. The ideal outcome for America would have been to turn Russia into another post-war Japan or Germany. That nearly happened, too. But there was too much resentment, and it lasted much longer than the tensions between America and its enemies during World War II. The Cold War never truly ended, at least for key players in Russia.
There's a conspiracy theory, said Junie, that the influx of Russian mafia to America was a deliberate tactic. After all, so many of them were former Soviet military.
There may be a great deal of truth in that, Miss Flynn, conceded Church, which supports the view that the Cold War hasn't ended. When the wall fell, the Cold War went dark, but it is still being fought as a long-game special operation. There are hawks on both sides, and in times when those hawks were not in open political power, they worked tirelessly behind the scenes. It's only been more recently that the hawkish views in Russia have become less well hidden, maybe because they knew that they were going to finally win that war.
So wrecking D.C. was what, their opening move? Asked Duffy. Are they going to hit New York next? If so, why aren't we going there? That's where the money is. That's the heart of the economy, unless I'm reading Forbes magazine wrong.
Money passes through there, said Church. It's the brains of the national economy, just as Washington is the center of the infrastructure. But it's not the heart of the economy.
Then what is?
I bent and tapped some keys on my laptop, and some pictures I'd preloaded popped onto the virtual walls of the orb. Oceans of wheat blowing in the wind, thousands of acres of corn and barley and soy, groves of fruit trees.
This is America, I said. This is what Valen is going to destroy.
Duffy shook his head.
How?
He'd need a million god machines to cause that many earthquakes.
No,
said Doc Holliday, her face draining of all color.
He won't. He could do it with the machines they've already sent to America.
But how?
Tell them, cowboy,
said Doc. I could see the precise moment when Junie got where I was going. She went pale as death. Doc, too. They looked like they wanted to flee, as if that was even possible. I pushed another key and one more image came up. It was of Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming. Beneath the park is the Yellowstone Caldera, I said. Church, you even listed it as a possible target when we were at the hospital.
One of our own analysts put together a paper on this a few years ago when we were tracking that apocalypse cult in Montana, the ones we thought might have brought in some old Soviet nukes bought on the Chechenian black market. Because Montana's just north of there, the analyst put the caldera at the top of our worry list, and for a good goddamn reason.
Maybe I wasn't in school that day, said Smith. But what the hell is a caldera?
It's a large volcanic crater, Doc explained. There's a huge one beneath Yellowstone National Park, between 35 to 45 miles across. Absolutely massive. There's a nasty geological hot spot, very similar to the Hawaiian Islands, actually, but this one's on continental crust rather than oceanic crust. Geologic hot spots are when molten rock or magma continuously upwells from the mantle, burning a hole in the lithospheric plate above. That's what causes eruptions on the surface of the Earth. What makes this one so bad is its size and location. Unlike in Hawaii, this one is not surrounded by ocean. It's surrounded by America's agricultural states. Shorthand answer is that we're talking about a supervolcano.
Well, shit, breathed Smith. Sorry I asked.
Buckle up, because here's more bad news. Each of the past three Yellowstone eruptions occurred between 600,000 to 800,000 years ago. The last one was 630,000 years ago, so we're technically due. By best geological guesses, though, there is only a small chance it will erupt in our lifetime.
Unless Valen uses his freaking machines, said Tate.
Yes. Duffy looked around. Okay, but we had Mount St. Helens, right? I mean, bad. Sure, but Doc looked sick.
Kids, if the Yellowstone caldera blew, we'd be looking at a force 2,500 times that of Mount St. Helens. That's a blast equal to 27,000 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs.
No one spoke. No one could.
The last one laid down a layer of ash over most of the western central United States that is estimated to have been 660 feet thick. That means the ash bed would have been thick enough to bury modern skyscrapers. And that doesn't even count the ash released into the atmosphere. A supervolcano would change the climate, cooling the earth. Maybe not into another ice age, but enough to affect crops.
How bad? Asked Bunny. Doc Holliday turned to him, and for once she was not wearing that perpetual smile. Maybe things had to get this bad for her to lose the jackal grin.
How bad? She echoed. Let's see. There would be about anywhere from 300 to 1,000 inches of ash over everything from Missoula to Denver and Boise to Rapid City. Gone. As much as 30 inches of it on the next ring outward from Seattle to Chicago. Beyond that, maybe as little as a couple of inches in New York. But all across the country's fields and farms, there would be destructive hot ash, which would also choke the streams and rivers. We would lose years' worth of crops, probably see a die-off of over 90% of animals like pigs, cows, and chickens. Timber and mining would stop, and you wouldn't have enough people left to bury the millions of dead.
And, I said into the absolute silence, we may be out of time to stop it. Chapter 126. Grand Hyatt Hotel, New York City, New York. Gadyuka sat cross-legged on the bed with three laptops around her. Her flight to Paris was scheduled to depart in 6 hours, which gave her plenty of time to watch it all start. Plenty of time before planes departing New York would be affected. She would be eating in a sidewalk cafe near the Louvre before it all fell apart. After that, she would take her time making her way back home. 3 or 4 weeks, with plenty of time to sightsee and watch history change via the media. The news from Washington was stunning, and all of the coded messages from back home were filled with congratulations and praise. The ones from the highest offices hinted at promotion, medals, and some more substantial rewards. The prudent part of her mind would have had her halfway back to Moscow by now, but where would be the fun in that? Fun.
She thought about that.
The word.
The concept. Was this fun?
Gadyuka reached over to the bedside table for the glass of vodka and took a thoughtful sip. The effect would be fun. The new Soviet, a new party, bigger and stronger than the one that had fallen when she was a little girl, something that would outlive her and would both dominate and stabilize the world. Yes, that would be fun. But getting there, well, that was something else. Valen was falling apart, and her people on the ground out west told her that he was looking stressed and a little manic. Gadyuka was more than a little certain that her pet mad scientist did not necessarily want to live in the new world he was creating. That was something she could understand. It would be a problem for the new Soviet to have so many sleeper agents and others who had spent so much time in the West return to live in a true communist society. Could they ever really adapt? And how could some, like Valen, reconcile what they had done with the peacefulness needed to be good citizens? Could she do it? When she'd read the emails and those hints at substantial rewards, was that a clue of some kind? A warning? Were they testing her to see if she was motivated by financial gain rather than the good of the party? In the old days, many millions had died to try and erase that hunger from the hearts and minds of the people. She sipped the vodka. It was Van Gogh, not even a Russian brand. The stuff was made in Holland, for God's sake. It was her favorite, and her next three favorite brands were Belvedere from Poland, 101 Vodka from California, and 42 Below, which came up from Australia. Gadyuka could not actually remember the last time she drank Russian vodka. She would have to give all of that up. Her fine clothes, the freedom to buy anything she wanted, anywhere she wanted. The food, good Lord, she would miss American food. And all these lovely vodkas. Gadyuka drained her glass and shimmied off the bed to get the bottle out of the ice bucket. She was halfway there when the door to her hotel room blew inward off its hinges. It slammed into her, lifted her, smashed her against the bureau. The TV leaned forward and fell, exploding in sparks as it landed, partly on the door and partly on her. At first, Gadyuka was too stunned to even understand what just happened. There was the smell of burned wood and plastic explosives in her nostrils and blood in her mouth. A fire alarm began screeching and the overhead sprinklers kicked on with a venomous hiss. She looked up and there, moving slowly through the smoke, was a figure. A woman she did not recognize. Tall, slender, in her late 50s or early 60s, with a face like a fierce and unforgiving queen in an old painting. She was dressed all in black. Pants, a form-fitting top, gloves. The woman tossed a small detonator onto the floor and drew a slender, double-edged blade from a sheath behind her back. "Get up," said the woman in a heavily accented voice. It was not a Russian accent, not a Russian face.
"What?"
stammered Gadyuka as she reached into her thigh holster for her gun. The door completely hid the action.
"I said get up,"
said the older woman. Gadyuka fired four shots through the door. Chapter 127 The Hangar, Floyd Bennett Field, Brooklyn, New York.
"The real question," said Junie Flynn, "is what would cause the Yellowstone caldera to erupt?"
She and Doc Holliday were in the orb alone now with Bug on the screen. Echo Team had signed off to try and cobble together a mission directive. Nevertheless, the holographic conference room was crammed with hundreds of images and lists of data and other information, some of it swirling as Mind Reader made connections, others stable and as fixed in place as a bullet hole.
"The last eruption at Yellowstone was about 630,000 years ago," said Doc. "To get things rolling now, if it was all left up to Mother Nature, and if she was in a bitchy mood, then you'd need the underground magma chambers to fill up and build pressure before it blows. What can Valen do with his damn machines?
Well, since I haven't had a chance to actually study the machines, I guess he'd have to use it to open conduits. Cracks, in other words. From depth, to allow magma to flow upward beneath Yellowstone. That happened around the Long Valley caldera in California in the 1980s. Lots of earthquakes and dome-like swelling were thought to indicate an imminent eruption. They evacuated people, but luckily it never blew. I saw the green reptile guy do something that folded the stone walls in the hallway at Pushkin like they were shower curtains. If that's how the technology works, then Valen can use them to open channels to the magma chambers.
Bug asked,
if they could do this, then why hit Washington?
Doc Holliday walked around the hologram of the God Machine, then turned to look at a series of photos of Valparaiso, the military base in Ukraine, and newer pictures of Washington. Junie fielded that.
Joe once tried to explain boxing to me. He said some boxers like to batter their opponent's arms to make them too sore and achy to lift, which makes them too slow to block a solid punch to the face. Other boxers go a different route and try to hit their opponent on the nose early on, especially if it looks like the other boxer's nose hasn't been broken before. It's a psychological and physiological thing. I mean, what happens when someone gets a broken nose?
Doc shrugged.
Intense pain, bleeding, externally, of course, from torn tissue, and internally. Blood in the throat and eustachian tubes, the eyes water. If the punch is heavy enough, there's even a chance of whiplash. And there's possible disorientation and loss of balance if the synovial fluids in the inner ear are disturbed. Right, all of that is disorienting and distracting. Joe says that he's won more fights by punching the nose than by any fancy martial arts moves. Plus, he says that we tend to ascribe emotional meaning to physiological effects. Break a nose and the boxer's eyes tear. For an experienced boxer, that's nothing, but to someone far less experienced, the tears are equated with crying, with weakness or fear.
Which then becomes an internal and therefore greater distraction, said Bug.
Okay, I get it. It's what boxers call taking the enemy's heart. They lose the fight because they are too distracted, too emotional, too confused, and no longer confident in their own strength.
Doc gave him a dazzling smile.
Well, well, you're more than a sexy mind and clever fingers, aren't you? I'll text you my private number. Behave, said Junie.
Where are you going with this? Asked Cole, steering the conversation back to the point. Junie spread her hands over the satellite image of Washington, D.C.
This is America's broken nose. We have a new administration, a president who isn't a politician and hasn't handled a major crisis, fractured infrastructure, political infighting, and party polarization. Then the earthquake hits. Now we have pain, distraction, indecision, the practical or perhaps impractical effects of party politics, disorientation, and too much raw emotion.
Cole's eyes went very round as the full impact of this hit her.
God Almighty. If Yellowstone blows, we're not going to be able to react or respond in any way except badly. Jesus H. Christ, Esquire. If we can't stop this, we're going to lose the whole damn country. Not just the crops, we'll lose everything, including any chance we have of protecting the survivors.
Duffy gave a weird little smile. But hey, no pressure. Chapter 128. Grand Hyatt Hotel, New York City, New York. The hotel door was heavy and it took effort to shove it off of herself, but as soon as it thumped away, Gadyuka scrambled to her knees, raising the gun, aiming it through the falling sprinkler water. At nothing. The older woman was not there. Water splatted down on the carpet, making bloody droplets dance. Then there was movement coming from her right, from the wrong side of the room. Gadyuka snarled and spun and fired. At the same time, a foot lashed out and caught her in the hip. Gadyuka whirled and tried to use the impact to spin her all the way around so she could slam her attacker with the butt of the